Ryan's eyes and nodded. No problem. Ryan opened the car door and wrapped his hand against the roof. Time to go, champ. Phillips moved as if in slow motion, not saying a word. Ryan put a firm hand in the small of his back and propelled him onward, not stopping to talk to the stragglers helping to catch a final quote for the early morning edition. Only when they were safely ensconced in his car did Ryan put both hands on the wheel and turn to his sergeant. Tell me you had a good reason to go in there, Frank. If there's anything you need to get off your chest, do it now and do it quickly. Phillips lifted his chin and then did something that Ryan had not expected. He covered his face with both hands and began to weep. Ryan stared at him much as he might stare at a carnival oddity, and if Phillips had been his usual self, he would have bellowed with laughter. Ryan wore an expression falling somewhere between constipation and panic, as he wondered what the hell to do. He had cried himself, of course he had. But it was always in private or, very rarely, in front of Anna. Over and done with quickly and not spoken of again. Well, it wasn't encouraged, was it? Boys were supposed to keep a stiff upper lip, and the story was no different when they grew up to be men. People said there was no shame in it, that it was a healthy expression of emotion and all that, but life experience had taught him differently. Cry baby. Wimp. Pussy. Maybe life had taught him the wrong lessons, Ryan realized, and pulled the man in for a hard hug. All right, Frank. It'll be all right. Phillips let himself be held by a friend and poured out the heartache he'd tried so hard to contain. Denise is gone. I know it. She's gone. Ryan clutched him in a bear grip and didn't move a muscle when Loison returned with three steaming hot cups of coffee. No, she's not. She's a born fighter, just like you. Chief Constable Morrison was waiting for them when Ryan finally turned his car back into the car park at SID headquarters. It was late, past 11, and they had lost track of the last time they ate or slept in their own beds. Phillips had purged himself, pouring out the whole sorry tale of what had happened to take him into the viper's nest, but the damage was already done and it was written all over Sandra Morrison's face. Her tired eyes passed between them and she didn't smile, she didn't even say a word. She simply led the way upstairs to her office. Once the door closed behind them, she didn't sit down, nor did she invite them to. Her voice was remote, impersonal, and her words fell like a death knell. Detective Sergeant Phillips, I am formally placing you on suspension pending a full disciplinary inquiry into allegations of gross misconduct and serious breaches of professional standards of behavior. Your behavior this evening has discredited our department, the police service, and may have damaged public confidence in the service that we provide. You have not been issued with a police caution, but an investigation is ongoing. In the circumstances and until further information comes to light, I am ordering an immediate suspension until further notice. Ryan vibrated with anger, but it was no more than Phillips had expected. This is bollocks. Ryan stabbed a finger in her general direction. Take a look at his hands. Just look. Moffa has an injury on the right side of his head, but Phillips is left-handed for God's sake. The man pushed a broken glass into his palm to smear it with blood and then smashed it into his own head. He's deranged. And the bouncer at the door? Morrison inquired, without rancor. Through the first punch, Ryan said. And the CCTV will prove it. unless that mental defective has wiped it. Morrison turned to Phillips and felt a tug at her heartstrings, but she hadn't climbed the police hierarchy with a reputation for being a soft touch. She believed in good practice, in order, and in fairness. If she made exceptions for old friends, she would lose the respect of her staff. Frank, what do you have to say? Unlike his younger friends, Phillips had lived more of life and developed a certain realism to temper his natural idealism. It meant that he was unsurprised by her decision, and had prepared himself for this outcome hours ago when he had sat quietly in his car outside Buddle's. He had no regrets. His violence had been controlled and, in his opinion, it had been necessary to obtain the information he now had in his possession. Given the choice, he would do it all over again. But he understood there was a price to pay for everything and it was Morrison's job to collect. There was no price he wouldn't pay to bring Denise safely home, and that included sacrificing a career he had spent over 30 years building. What was a job, compared with the woman he loved? I've nothing else to say, ma'am. I've given a full statement to Tyne and Ware Area Command and I place my trust in them to complete a thorough investigation. I went to the diner to speak to the man who financed the hacker and I walked away having achieved that. Morrison waited while she swallowed the lump in her throat, until she was sure that her voice betrayed nothing of her inner turmoil. Very well, she nodded, while Ryan rocked back on his heels in shock and Loisant stared at Phillips in dumbfounded confusion. Morrison directed her parting comments to them. I hardly need to add that there are strict protocols regarding information sharing. If I find out that any of them have been breached, I will not hesitate to instigate further investigations of misconduct. I now have the task of rebuilding confidence in this department, while the public is already terrified that a killer is on the loose. To say I'm disappointed would be an understatement. Don't give me reason to be even more disappointed. You have been warned. Chapter 17. Jimmy Moffa preferred not to shit in his own backyard. He made a habit of conducting business in the city and commuting home in the evenings, where he could pretend he was an upstanding member of the community and play golf at the weekend. He lived in an elite neighborhood known as Darrah's Hall, on the gentrified western edge of Newcastle and a mere stone's throw from Northumbria Police Headquarters. It brought him an odd sort of comfort to know that the Blues were so close at hand and that his high-tech panic alarm system was rigged up to their offices. They would have to come running if he so much as accidentally tripped the switch, which was a source of endless amusement to him. It thrilled him to know that he walked among the pigs, taunting them with his presence. So near, yet always so far away from lockup. In the 70s and 80s, Darrah's Hall had bloomed into a colony of sorts, where the nouveau riche could help themselves to a taste of the good life. Footballers, entrepreneurs, career criminals, their wives, their husbands, their mistresses and their children mingled with entrepreneurs, doctors, lawyers and property developers. A lot of property developers. Not that he minded the blokes who overextended themselves on bad credit. He'd picked up a brand new, neoclassical mansion with an acre of manicured gardens thanks to a slump in property prices and the greed of one such local businessman, and he wouldn't have it any other way. Moffa's home was his showpiece, his retreat and most importantly the physical evidence of how successful he had become. He was still young enough to remember the two up, two down where he'd been born in Manchester. He remembered the hand-me-downs, the threadbare carpet and the cheap food. The house was always cold and everything had seemed to be an ugly shade of grey, the kind of sepia hue that filmmakers used in artsy films about poverty, written from the comfort of a paneled study. His father did what he could to better himself and his family, but the old man had been careless. He'd taught his boys how to hate, how to steal and how to kill. Then he'd promptly gone and got himself killed instead. Careless old bugger. Jimmy could see that same carelessness in his elder brothers. They snorted too much powder and it made them sloppy and arrogant. They lived off the fat of the land, their men grew lazy and mistakes were made while they looked the other way and partied on a yacht in Ibiza. But that wasn't his way. He never touched anything other than sparkling water and milky coffee. He was known for it, but nobody would dare mock him within earshot and expect to leave without two broken legs. Yet, after so many careful, cautious years, he found himself ready to open the enormous lead gates of his new-build mansion to a man who threatened the equilibrium he had worked so hard to maintain. They sat side by side in the back seat of his Porsche while Tony pulled into the driveway and Moffa could feel sweat beading his face and neck, for the first time in years. What was he doing? Ear Edwards was adept at exploiting people's weaknesses. Since it was a talent they both shared, that made it easy to recognize. Moffa didn't flatter himself that Edwards wanted him. He was under no illusions that the man hoped to talk his way out of payment or talk his way into a different kind of partnership, perhaps to squeeze him for more money or a ticket out of the country. He suspected the man wasn't even gay or at the very least bisexual like himself. Edwards was just an opportunist who wasn't fussy either way. But when he looked into those deep midnight eyes, all doubts and sense of self-preservation flew merrily out of the window. He needed to know what it felt like to be with someone of his own distinction. Just once in his life, he wanted to be on equal terms with a man who wasn't there because he was too frightened to refuse. He supposed that made him careless, too. Anna drove along winding country roads towards the picturesque village of Blankland, beneath a sky that was speckled with stars. The task force assigned to Operation Ireland was buckling under the strain of a never-increasing workload, even though much of the grunt work had been farmed out to neighboring divisions. It was not just that they hunted a dangerous man who seemed proficient at staying beneath the radar, or that they were tasked with investigating the death of a teenage girl who had found herself in the wrong place at the wrong time. They faced a loss of public confidence, internal politics within the police hierarchy, and the constant knowledge that one of their number was still very much missing. Against that backdrop, Ryan remained at the helm to work throughout the night, for the second night in a row. Exhausted and wrung out, Anna had volunteered to drive Phillips home to the temporary accommodation they would all share. She knew that, despite everything that had happened, Ryan trusted nobody more than Phillips, and he could rest easy in the knowledge that she would be safe in his hands. Anna had almost given up trying to convince Ryan that she didn't need protecting or that she was more than capable of fending for herself. It wasn't a question of gender, or about being a mere civilian. It was a question of survival against an unpredictable foe, and she was intelligent enough to know that two heads were better than one when dealing with a threat like that. Even better yet, several heads with specialist firearms training. Almost there, she said quietly, blinking through the darkness to remain alert as she swerved and braked for the hefted sheep that roamed freely through the hills. She had read somewhere about sheep that had never known the indignity of a pen, but had been reared through the generations to keep to a certain patch of land. Sometime over the years a road had been built, cutting directly across the North Pennines, but the sheep didn't seem to mind the encroachment on their turf. "I," Phillips mumbled, lost in thought. "What are you going to do now, Frank?" Phillips watched the passing landscape and felt insignificant in the universe, a tiny speck in the enormous fabric of life. What would he do? Everything that he could. "I've been taken off the investigation," he reminded her, "for appearance's sake." "But nobody said anything about where you could or couldn't live." "Did they?" Phillips rubbed a hand across the stubble on his jaw and the bristle snagged against the bandage on his hand, reminding him of how he had come by it. "I don't reckon they did." "That being the case, it would hardly be your fault if you, let's say, accidentally stumbled across some files that Ryan left out. On the kitchen table, for example." Phillips grinned at the passing fields and turned to cast an appreciative look in her direction. "I'm sure it happens all the time," he agreed. "And, if you were to read them, it wouldn't prejudice the investigation because you wouldn't be obtaining evidence or anything like that, now would you?" "You're a crafty lass," Phillips said. "I've always liked that about you." Anna chuckled, then reduced her speed as they passed a signpost telling them they had reached Blankland. They admired the shadowed houses and ancient church lit by powerful uplighters, keeping a comfortable silence until Anna pulled up in front of a stone cottage with a painted burgundy door to match all the others in a neat row. They got out of the car, stretched their aching muscles, and Anna walked around to open the boot. "Frank, give me a hand with this, will you?" Philip sloped across and glanced down into the boot, which was filled to the brim with copies of the old case files relating to Ear Edwards, alongside newer files pertaining to the current investigation. "When did Ryan get time to swipe these?" "He didn't," Anna corrected him. "But he did ask me to run up some copies. Luckily for both of you, I wasn't in the mood for reading about Viking raids today." "Thank Odin," Phillips declared. Pizza boxes and empty cans of sugary pop were piled high in the corner of the incident room, next to a bin overflowing with rubbish accumulated over the last 24 hours. Ryan knew he was already expecting too much of his team to continue working indefinitely. To expect them to do it on an empty stomach would be adding insult to injury. He therefore put a call through to the pizza delivery shop and ordered 10 extra large stuffed crust, fully loaded. It might not be the healthy or nutritious option, but when one was engrossed in the task of finding a killer, salad just didn't cut it. Loison looked up from his desk when the scent of baked cheese carried across the room, sniffing the air like a hungry wolf. "Did you order a veggie pizza?" Ryan gave him a pitying glance from his position a couple of desks over. "Jack, we've been through this before. Can I help it if you refuse to eat normally?" Loison rolled his eyes. "Let me rephrase the question. Which pizza has the least meat on it, so I can pick it off?" Ryan pointed towards a small margarita he'd kept apart from the others. "Only joking, kiddo. I know how much you care about the cute little animals." Loison's face lit up and he shoveled half a slice into his mouth, chewing blissfully while his arteries clogged with cholesterol. "If I die, I'll die happy," he muttered. "What's that?" "Never mind. Where are we?" Ryan leaned back in his desk chair and ran both hands through his mop of black hair, in an automatic gesture while he ordered his mind. "Phillips is going to stay with us for a while." He decided to begin with the most recent emergency and work backward. "He's going to look after Anna." "Or is she going to look after him?" Loison reached for another slice of pizza. Let's say it's an even exchange, Ryan admitted, lowering his voice a fraction. I've left them with copies of the files to look over. I want to know about any locations Edwards mentioned in his statements over the years, including all past addresses. We already know about his old house in Jesmond, but I want to go back, all the way back, to see where else he has roots. MMMFFH, Loison agreed. Faulkner has sent through the forensics report, Ryan continued. He confirms the Toyota that was abandoned on the quayside had been driven by Edwards and that spots of Mackenzie's blood were found in the boot space. They found mud on the tires, which they're analyzing as a priority to see if it can tell us anything about where he's been, or where he might still be hiding. How are you getting along with tracing his new vehicle? Loison gargled with full fat coke and dug his heels into the carpet to propel his desk chair across the short gap between his desk and Ryan's. First of all, you were right about the CCTV overlooking the car park at Wharf Square. It went offline from 1:17 this morning. He paused to check the clock on the wall and was relieved to see that it was still Tuesday. Yes, in the early hours of this morning. We can make an educated guess that Edwards was responsible for that. Sounds like another one of those coincidences, Ryan put in. Yeah, it is. But get this. We've traced the registered owners of every car that was sitting in the parking bays before then and all of them are in possession of their vehicles, except one. Ryan just smiled, letting Loison have his moment. Please tell me Edwards is swanning around in a battered old three-wheeler, like Del Boy. No such luck. The missing car is a metallic grey Mercedes sports coupe. Sounds similar to mine, Ryan observed. He must have been delighted to find that. Loison cleared his throat awkwardly. It's actually the same car as yours, except it's a newer model. Ryan lifted his chin. Not all of us are concerned with keeping up with the Joneses, he said, in dignified tones. How far have you traced it? Loison flipped the page of his notebook. Here's the interesting part. We've got it traveling through the city center and along the West Road until it joined the A69 at 1:32. The last sighting we have is just before the slip road that would take you to the airport, and we know it didn't come off the motorway at that point, which means it must have traveled further along the A69. We also know it didn't go as far as Hexham or even Corbridge because there's no footage outside either town. You know what that means? Ryan knew exactly what it meant, but he didn't want to ruin Loison's flow. Tell me. It means that the Mercedes would have come to the Stifford roundabout at some point on his journey and benefited from the same lack of recording devices as before. Ryan steepled his index fingers and rested them against his lips. It has to be Edwards, following the same route back to whatever rock he's been hiding under for the past week. I want every police officer in the Northeast to be on alert for that vehicle, or vehicles matching the same description, if not the same number plate. Get a description out to the press and tell them to offer a reward for anybody who can offer a genuine sighting of that Mercedes. Already done, Loison said, a bit smugly. Then go back over all the footage on the roads leading from the Stifford roundabout during the relevant timescale when Mackenzie was taken. We didn't have a chance before, but now we know that Edwards exchanged her red Fiesta for a dark blue Toyota. Hundreds of possibilities just got whittled down to one. The analysts are going over it now. Loesen nodded towards a small group of three crime analysts with their noses pressed to the screens of their respective computers, rolling through hours of CCTV footage. They let us know the moment they spot it. Then we'll know the direction and, hopefully, the destination it was headed.
Good.
Good, Ryan repeated, thinking of the million other plates he had spinning in the air. I heard from Pinter, down at the mortuary. He's sent through an updated report on Beth Finnegan's post-mortem, but I'd advise you to digest your pizza before reading it. Loesen had a flash memory of Bethany's headless body and felt cheesy tomato repeat on him. How about her mother? Ryan rubbed the heels of his hands against itchy, bloodshot eyes. Devastated, he said shortly, not wanting to think back to that painful conversation. Of all the people he had met, he would remember Kelly Finnegan as one of the strongest, as well as the most vulnerable. Loesen rubbed his hands on a paper napkin, feeling at a loss. I spoke to the Solicitors Regulation Authority, Ryan changed the subject. I've asked them for a complete list of Elaine Hoffman Smith's clients, aside from the hacker. They won't agree to send it without an appropriate warrant, which I've already put in motion. With any luck, we'll have a magistrate sign it off first thing tomorrow. After then, we'll be able to confirm whether Jimmy Moffa and Ear Edwards shared the same solicitor. If they did, I'll be asking for copies of all communications. If Frank is right, she was the one who put the two of them in contact and passed messages between them. Loesen nodded thoughtfully, thinking back to the woman he had interviewed that very morning, which felt like a lifetime ago now. Yes, I think she would be capable of that. If she was, she's responsible for facilitating the deaths of, Ryan caught himself before saying two women. At least one woman, since Edwards broke free. He could be out there now, killing another one. Loesen turned towards the window. Ryan followed the direction of his gaze and saw their tired faces reflected in the darkened glass. He looked away and began to call up the next document on his screen, this time a summary from one of the reader receivers containing a log of telephone calls received following a Crime Stoppers reconstruction that had aired on national television a couple of days earlier. Whoever it is, they don't deserve what's about to happen to them. Jimmy Moffa employed a daily housekeeper called Irene, who began work just before 7 a.m. so that she could be on hand to prepare a healthy breakfast and take care of his immediate needs. She stayed all day to ensure the house was kept to his exacting standards of cleanliness and then departed in her three-door Mazda on the dot of 4:30, in time to miss the traffic on her way home. Irene was a woman in her mid-50s with a sharp eye for dust and grime and a selective eye for all other things. If Jimmy's clothes were often stained with blood, she reasoned that he must have been walking through a rough area of town. She tutted and fussed and baked pies that he never ate but enjoyed having for their homely scent. She chose to deceive herself about the true nature of her employer's business in exchange for the generous wages he paid, and she slept like a baby every night. Irene was the only person granted entry into Moffa's home, except on very special occasions. His bodyguards were required to sit or stand outside the exterior doors. On their first day at work, he walked them through the house so that they knew its layout and where to come running in case of an emergency, but, for the most part, he relied on high-spec radio devices to communicate with them. Moffa kept his home and his business strictly separate, and all negotiations or meetings were conducted at the All-American Diner, never inside the suburban bubble he had created for himself. Jimmy's reputation was so fierce that nobody had ever tried to gain access to his home, so he had never lived to regret the lack of security inside his house, or his own complacency. until now. When his driver cum bodyguard took up his position beside the front door, Moffo was tempted to break his own rule and ask Tony to come inside and hover around somewhere within shouting distance. But to do so would mean losing face in front of Edwards, who was leaning against one of the pillars and watching him with growing amusement in his enigmatic black eyes. "Shall we?" Edwards motioned towards the front doors, which were polished oak with grandiose plaster pillars and had miniature potted conifers to either side. "Or did you forget your key, sweetheart?" "I'm wondering whether you're worth the effort," Moffa replied, with an air of challenge. Edwards merely smiled. "I'll leave that for you to decide." Meanwhile, Tony was sweating inside his new suit as he watched their exchange. He was painfully aware of the fact that he was way, way out of his depth. What had started out as a temporary gig, just something well paid to tide him over, was spiraling into a nightmare beyond his control, and Philip's words replayed in his head. "What would Yoda say if he could see you now?" Tony swallowed and tugged at the collar of his shirt, wishing fervently that he hadn't lied about his past exploits to get the job in the first place. "Ah, Mr. Moffa?" "What?" His eyes darted across to where Edwards watched him like a spider. "Do you need me to stay all night?" Edwards laughed heartily and pursed his lips. "I'm not as young as I used to be," he admitted. "But I'm sure I could give it a go." Moffo ignored him, feeling like the butt of a private joke. "He'll be leaving in a couple of hours," he replied, tersely. "I expect you to drive Mr. Edwards back to his car. Stay here until then and let me know immediately if anybody approaches or if you hear from the boys at the diner. Rory is around the back and Kieran is on the side gate." "You're not alone," he lied, keeping one eye on the man who listened intently. Tony felt much better. The hacker might be one of the country's most dangerous men, but nobody had ever said he was stupid and he wouldn't try anything when the odds were stacked against him, 4-1. But Moffat turned away with a sick feeling in his stomach because he knew that Rory and Kieran weren't manning the doors tonight at all. They were probably sitting in front of their television sets without a care in the world as they enjoyed a night off. It was time to roll the dice and see where they fell. Chapter 18. An hour passed slowly for Tony, who stood shivering beneath the glow of a faux 19th-century gas lamp outside Moffa's lavish front door. April was a cold month in the north of England and the night air billowed against his bulky frame, whipping roses into his cheeks so that he appeared much younger than his years. He'd forgotten to bring an overcoat and gazed longingly at the Porsche sitting on the driveway, imagining the warm gust of a heated air conditioning system, but he daren't risk leaving his post. One of the other guards might wander around the house, grass him up, and that would be the end of that. Funny that he hadn't heard them talking on the radio, he thought suddenly, and tapped the earpiece tucked around his left earlobe. There was no sound from the other guards, but Moffa's broad Mancunian accent carried clearly through the airwaves. Tony tried not to focus on the words but on the tone. So long as Jimmy sounded happy enough, he wasn't needed. He didn't want to focus on the details of Moffa's conversation with Gear Edwards, for the same reason that he didn't particularly want to hear about anybody else's sex life. It was like listening to his parents going at it, or, worse still, his grandparents. Everybody knew it happened, but the least said about it, the better for all concerned. Tony winced as the conversation became more explicit and he felt like the worst kind of voyeur. He was starting to wonder if there was a volume control on his earpiece, when the voices stopped. Just like that. Tony tapped his earpiece again and wondered if there was a problem, caught in an agony of indecision. Jimmy had made it very clear that the house was out of bounds unless there was an absolute emergency. Was this an emergency? His boss might have turned off his radio communicator so that he could enjoy some private time with his guest. It would be mortifying if he barged inside the house and interrupted them. It would be the end of his career, and who knows what else Jimmy might inflict as punishment for his stupidity. On the other hand, Ear Edwards was a serial killer. Killer being the operative word. Tony picked up his heels and jogged around the side of the house to seek advice from the other guards, feet crunching against the gravel. Bright, motion sensor spotlights flickered on as he moved, shining through the windows of the shadowed house and helping to pinpoint his location to anybody who might be watching from the interior. He rounded the back of the house and skidded to a halt. The wide, semicircular terrace was completely in darkness except for a weak, greenish-yellow glow from three more old-fashioned lamps that served as a design feature rather than an effective light source. Solar-powered lighting dotted the expansive lawn, and he could see low-lying mist swirling over the grass as night dragged into a new day, but he couldn't see any other security guards. The chair positioned beside the rear patio doors where Rory should have been sitting was empty, and there was no sign of Kieran manning the side gate. Tony's stomach lurched and he stood there for a moment, frozen. Should he go into the house to help his boss? Something was very, very wrong, and there was still no sound from the radio in his ear. His body made the decision before his brain caught up, and his feet edged backward. With panting breaths, he turned and sprinted back around to the front of the house, towards the car sitting on the driveway ready to take him back to safety. The lights flamed into life again as he flew across the ground and grasped the door handle. He cast furtive glances behind him, at the big oak doors with their ridiculous knockers in the shape of golf sticks, and felt a moment's guilt at the prospect of abandoning Jimmy to his fate. Then it was overtaken by a much stronger survival instinct. He wrenched open the car door and threw himself inside, slamming it behind him and fumbling with the interior locks. He risked another glance towards the house and was relieved to see that nobody had come to stop him. He reached down to grasp the ignition key, but his fingers clawed the air instead. Wah! He caught a flash of movement in the rearview mirror, but it was already too late. The blade sliced a clean arc from ear to ear, severing his jugular, and blood began to pump from his neck in an ocean of red, staining the cream leather seats. PC Paul Cox had been a dispatcher at the Northumbria Constabulary Control Room for nearly 3 years, and he was growing weary of the monotony. It went against his natural circadian rhythms to be up so late at night, and he was seriously considering putting in for a transfer. His wife was expecting their first child, and he didn't want to be working such unsociable hours, dealing with the dregs of society, when he could be at home with her and their new bundle. He smiled at the prospect, then his face fell as an alert came through from one of the local alarm monitoring centers. He recognized the address of the so-called emergency straight away. It was the fourth time this year that Jimmy Moffey had cried wolf, just because he enjoyed seeing hard-working police officers running around after him. Sick bastard. Well, not this time, Paul decided. Three false alarms and the official guidelines permitted him to refuse a police response, and that's exactly what he was going to do. With a superior smirk, he moved on to the next emergency. Mackenzie had developed hearing like a bat over the past 7 days spent in captivity. The instant she heard Edward's soft tread on the grass outside the front door, She sat bolt upright and moved quietly to the bedroom window. She stood with her back flush to the wall and inched forward so that she could peer through the tiny gap. It was dark outside and the moon was hidden behind a blanket of thick cloud, providing little relief. Even in the darkness, she knew that he had sensed her watching him. "Hello, Ruth," he called up to the window, and she plastered herself back against the wall, angry to have been found out so quickly. "Have you missed me?" She heard his soft laughter carrying on the night air, then the jingle of a key turning in the lock downstairs. A moment later, the front door slammed and she squeezed her eyes shut, listening for the sound of his tread on the staircase. There hadn't been enough time to recover her strength, she thought desperately, but she hurried into position anyway. Her legs trembled as fresh adrenaline coursed through her body, pushing through the leftover groggy feeling from the sedative he had given her. She realized what he had done when she'd first woken up with a throbbing headache and a dry mouth, but she hadn't been surprised or angry. In fact, she was relieved it hadn't been anything worse. Now that the grogginess had worn off, she readied herself for action, arms poised and feet placed in the spot she had earmarked as being the perfect distance to strike. Feet coming up the stairs. She stood perfectly still in the silent room, eyes accustomed to the darkness and strained on the locked door. Then, at the top of the stairs, she heard him turn in the opposite direction towards the bathroom. A moment later, there came the sound of a bath running. "Night, Ruth." Mackenzie felt hot, angry tears flood her eyes and course down her cheeks. After all the build-up, he denied her another opportunity to break free. It would have to be the morning, now, but she didn't know how long her courage would last and a lot could happen in the small hours of the night. "Gotcha." Lois bellowed across the breadth of the incident room and did a funny little victory dance on the spot. Ryan watched him indulgently and then crooked a finger. "Jack, stop pretending to be Shakira and get your ass over here." "It's often been said that my hips don't lie." "Among other things," Ryan muttered, with a raised eyebrow towards the freshly printed papers Lowerson was clutching in his hand. "These are screenshots of the Toyota," Lowerson waved them triumphantly. "We've got it heading south along the A68 from the Stiford roundabout on the night Mackenzie was taken, as far as Carterway Heads." He named a small village where the road once again became a crossroads. "We checked it against footage for the missing Mercedes and, guess what? It took exactly the same route during the early hours following Beth Finnegan's murder. We've traced the Mercedes as far as Carterway Heads again, thanks to a CCTV camera at the petrol station which is angled to face the road. It seems to take a right turn, bearing west towards the North Pennines and Weardale." Ryan was less familiar with that part of the countryside, which was the usual province of Durham Constabulary. He rose from his chair to walk across to the enormous map on the wall so that he could get his bearings, and one of the first things he noticed was that the village of Blanklund lay only a few miles west of Carterway Heads. His heart began to pound. "What about after then?" he asked, already reaching for the phone in his jeans pocket to put a call through to Anna. "Where did the cars go after Carterway Heads?" Lowerson tried not to feel deflated. "It was progress, just not quite enough. That's all we've got so far. That whole area is like a black hole, for mobile signal, for CCTV, you name it. Edwards probably chose it because he knew it would act like a force field." Ryan gave him a look. "This is the 21st century. Edwards can't survive indefinitely without using modern conveniences. He'll need to go to the shop, access money from somewhere, fill up on petrol. Actually, there's a thought, he said. Call the petrol station at Cartaway Heads and see if he's been in. Lowison nodded and made a mental note. I'll speak to Faulkner and ask him to focus his attention specifically on the soil samples usually found in that part of the world. We might be able to narrow the field even further. Lowison flicked a finger against the papers he held in his hand. There's something else, he added, before Ryan hit call on his mobile phone. What's that? We've got the Mercedes heading back north through Cartaway Heads at 21:17 this evening. I've got the analysts working to trace the other checkpoints, to see where it went after then. But he went hunting again, Ryan concluded, wrapping his fist around the mobile phone in his hand. What he did to that girl wasn't enough to sustain him, so he came back for a second helping. Lowison looked down at his shoes, trying not to think about what could be worse than decapitation. I don't understand how it wasn't apostrophe T dot wasn't. What? Enough for him? Ryan put in, then shook his head. That's because you're thinking like a normal person, Jack, and you need to remember that Ear Edwards isn't normal. He's barely even a person. He could hear them going at it again on the other side of the wall, and it was the same sound every time. Thud, thud, thud. The sound of the bedstead hitting the wall, mingling with the sound of her gasping cries. It didn't sound like pleasure, he thought. It sounded like the keening wail of an animal in pain or the awful whine of foxes mating in the night. He often heard them, from his bedroom window. And still, the noises continued. Thud, thud, thud. At first, he tried holding his hands against his ears or burying his head beneath the bedclothes, but nothing drowned out the sound. The partition walls in the old house had been added some time after it was first built, and they were cheap and thin, providing no sound insulation at all. After another minute, the banging stopped and he heard other sounds. The groan of floorboards in his mother's bedroom as the man stepped from her bed, followed by the creak of the bedroom door opening. Three heavy steps to the bathroom next door and the sound of a tap running and water sloshing onto the floor. A moment later, the tinkle of piss hitting the porcelain and the toilet flushing. Three steps back to the bedroom. The sound of her pleading with him to stay with her, just for a little while. His curt response in the negative, then clothes rustling as the man tugged on his trousers and prepared to leave. More pleading. Please, Charles. He heard her tugging at the man, pawing at him to stay with her, and he felt sick with disgust. His body jerked in reaction as he heard the unmistakable sound of flesh hitting flesh, followed by her whine. Footsteps clattered down the stairs with indecent haste, and there came the dim sound of the front door opening and slamming shut again. He froze in his bed and waited for the final, inevitable sound that would lull him to sleep. He was not disappointed, for his mother began to sob harsh, gut-wrenching tears that carried through the wall and filled the air of his room, flooding his young mind with the sound that would haunt him for the rest of his life. Mackenzie woke with a start, covered in sweat. Her first thought was that she had not meant to fall asleep. Her second thought was gratitude that she was still alive and he hadn't stolen into her room to murder her while she slept. Anything was possible when you were dealing with a disordered mind like Edwards. She cast dazed eyes around the room, seeking out the source of the sound that had woken her, creeping softly from the bed to stand in the center of the cracked wooden floor. It came again, a long wailing cry. The sound of it tore through her, piercing the silent night air like a banshee. She stumbled to the window and shivered against the night air, peering through the gloom to see if an animal had come to harm. But she realized that it had not been a fox, not this time. The cry had come from the room next door, where Edward slept. Chapter 19. Wednesday, 6th April. Less than 5 miles away from the old farmhouse where Mackenzie was being held captive, Anna awoke in a strange bed in the village of Blankland to the sound of birdsong, alongside an odd, rumbling sound which reminded her of a steam engine. Rubbing sleep from her eyes, she padded barefoot down the narrow stairs of the holiday cottage to seek out the source. She found Phillips half sitting, half lying in an armchair he had dragged from the sitting room into the hallway to face the door. After Ian's call last night, they had redoubled their efforts to go through the old files from Edward's past, searching for any mention of a location in the North Pennines region to the west of Durham. When nothing had turned up and they were unable to stay awake any longer, Frank had resolved himself to protect her in Ryan's stead, but Anna was glad to see he had obviously fallen into a fitful sleep at some point during the night and his snores now filled the small house. She stood quietly watching him, wishing there was something she could do to help put an end to his heartache, when she noticed that he clutched a firearm against his chest. Her heart skidded at the sight of the small handgun, which she knew to be the same model as Ryan's, currently in a locked box upstairs. The Glock 17 was the semi-automatic pistol of choice for authorized firearms officers at Northumbria SID, and she knew that Phillips, Ryan and Mackenzie had completed their training at the same time before she'd met any of them. It was the kind of knowledge she often forgot about, having rarely seen them holding a gun or having one anywhere within sight. It was only when she queried the little metal box Ryan chose to bring with him from their cottage in Durham that he had reminded her of its contents. The knowledge left her feeling uneasy. That same uneasy feeling returned as she watched her friend sleeping, his jowly face relaxed into a puppy dog expression that was at odds with the dangerous weapon clutched in his inert hand. Her father had owned a hunting rifle, and she remembered a time when she and her sister had been young, when he'd taken them out to a nature reserve with the long rifle slung over his shoulder. "Where are we going, Dad?" "You girls need to learn how to defend yourselves," he'd slurred, through his usual measure of alcohol before midday. "Can't rely on anybody else, and there's evil in this world." He'd ushered them under the fence into the wildlife reserve, a place where rare birds and mammals should have been free to roam without man's interference. Her father had warned them to keep back while he shot a kestrel sitting in a nearby tree. The image of its falling wings was something she had never forgotten. Another memorable occasion had seen Ryan bursting into the tower room at Lindisfarne Castle 2 years ago, firing his Glock to wound a man who would have killed her without his intervention. At the time, she was grateful to be alive and didn't overthink the processes. But now that she knew Ryan better, she realized how much it must have cost him to pull the trigger. He devoted his life to preventing human destruction, so the very act of discharging a weapon went deeply against the grain, as it did for the gentleman snoring in the armchair in front of her. Anna clutched her woolen jumper close to her chest and stepped forward, making little sound. She hesitated, then reached out her hand to remove the handgun, intending to put it on a shelf somewhere out of reach. The moment her fingers brushed the metal, Philip's eyes flew open and his hand tightened. "Morning, lass." Ryan stared at the buttons on the vending machine and eventually selected the one claiming to dispense espresso. As he watched the steaming liquid hit the bottom of a white polystyrene cup, his thoughts wandered back to the investigation. He and Loison had been up all night with a skeleton team of staff trying to trace the whereabouts of the stolen Mercedes. They strongly believed it to be the vehicle Edwards was using, and they had made some progress tracing it as far as the A69 heading towards Newcastle. There were three smaller exits from the motorway before the next main checkpoint, where a camera would have caught the Mercedes if it had driven past. Since there was no such recording, they had to assume Edwards exited earlier via one of the smaller back roads. Any one of them would lead to the area around Ponteland, Darrah's Hall and the western edge of the city around SID headquarters, so it was another kick in the teeth to know that Edwards had practically been on their doorstep and they still hadn't captured him. Loison was in the process of obtaining footage from any local businesses or private residences along those back roads, but it was a slow and difficult task which had reaped few rewards so far. Privately, they realized that any progress they made in finding the Mercedes would come long after Edwards had finished his exploits the previous evening, whatever they might have been. They were constantly playing catch-up. Ryan experienced a sense of insult to go alongside the feeling of acute failure that intensified with every passing day. Logically, he knew they were doing everything they could. No expense had been spared in their quest to bring Mackenzie home and Edwards into custody. But still, this was a very personal investigation and he felt a peculiar sense of ownership regarding Ear Edwards. He didn't usually care about who received credit for a final collar, but, in this case, he wanted to be the man to plant a boot in the small of Edwards' back as he kicked his sorry ass back into prison, preferably one with a wire net covering over its exercise yard. It was becoming increasingly clear that, despite all their hard work, the forensic examinations, the television, newspaper, digital and radio coverage, they remained at the mercy of a man who had gone deep undercover with all the skill of a veteran spy. If Faulkner came through with a lead on the geographical origin of the mud found on the Toyota's tires, they could start going door to door in a manageable radius. Likewise, if they stumbled across something buried in one of the old files, it was possible it might lead them straight to Edwards' front door. On the other